Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. I will be joined today for this episode by my regular co-host, Max Musson from Western Spring, and we will be discussing Robert Blatchford. In particular, we will be using quotes from his book, Merry England. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Britons then?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, Greatest Britons for today, as we mentioned earlier, is Robert Peel Glanville Blatchford. And what we're going to do today is actually have a look through some of the quotes from his Merry England book. Now, I believe the book itself was a selection from his Clarion newspaper. Is that right, Max?
That I'm not absolutely sure of, but I would imagine that there probably would be a large area of overlap in any event, because the book was written at the same sort of time that the Clarion newspaper was being published. So I would think that there will be a great area of overlap. But Blatchford did very often refer in all of his writings to this mythical Mr. Smith, who was the his equivalent of the man on the Clapham omnibus that he would address with the logic and the arguments he was putting forward in order to improve the governance of Britain.
So when he's when we're actually going through these quotes, he's basically, it's a hypothetical conversation between him and this Mr. John Smith. That's why he's mentioning the name Mr. Smith or John Smith as he goes through. Well, he starts off, he says, "To reject an idea because it is new is not a proof of shrewd sense. It is a proof of bigoted ignorance. To say that an idea is new is not to prove that it is untrue. The oldest idea was new once, and some of my ideas, as for instance the idea that justice and health are precious things, are considerably older than the House of Commons or Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. If you wish for an instance of the value of new ideas, Mr. Smith, get a good life of Charles Darwin and another of George Stevenson and read them." And I'm obviously aware of Charles Darwin. Who's the George Stevenson that he's talking about here? Is that George Stevenson of the railways? Do you know?
I believe so, yes.
Wow. So so he's a fan of George Stevenson, one of our greatest Britons. He continues, "Now then, what is the problem? I call it the problem of life. We have here a country and a people. The problem is, given a country and a people, to find how the people may make the best of the country and of themselves. First then, as to the capacities of the country and the people. The country is fertile and fruitful and well stored with nearly all the things that the people need. The people are intelligent, industrious, strong, and famous for their perseverance, their inventiveness, and resource. It looks then as if such a people in such a country must certainly succeed in securing health and happiness and plenty for all. But we know very well that our people, or at least the bulk of them, have neither health nor pleasure nor plenty." Now, I think this is interesting because he's talking about the British people here, the British race. He says they're intelligent, industrious, strong, famous for their perseverance, their inventiveness, and resource. And that's comparing the British people to the Italians, the Germans, the French. And this is at a time when we didn't just look at everybody as being the white race or as Europeans. We measured ourselves up against the other nations of Europe and the small differences that there are between them. I mean, I guess you could say that the Italians are very musical and they're very into their food. The Germans are very philosophical. And what he's saying here is that the British are industrious and very, very inventive and have perseverance. And this is what led to us getting the empire, basically. And that's really what stood out to me from that, is just this lovely description of the British people here. Max, what are your thoughts on this quote here?
Yeah, I would agree with that entirely. It's it is a statement of what would be regarded as the obvious if we were to go back 100 years because it was evident that as far as the Industrial Revolution was concerned, that British inventors led the way as far as the Industrial Revolution was concerned, as far as the Agricultural Revolution is concerned. We led the way again with modernization of agriculture. I think if you look at things that have been invented going back through history, then a very disproportionately large amount of the things that have been invented and a very disproportionately large number of the patents that exist on things that have been invented were things invented by British people. And certainly if you look at our literature, I think English literature is richer than the literature of virtually any other country, or at least stands comparable with the literature of any other highly literate nation. And so we have been a small island, but a small island that has, because of the stability created by the fact that we are an island, that we have had a society that has nurtured people who are inventive and self-reliant.
I think there it's also descriptions of traits that are heritable as well: intelligent, industrious, strong, inventive, and resourceful. I mean, it's not like anybody can join that club. It's inheritable. It's talking about the ethnic nation. It's talking about things that the British people have inherited from their ancestors. I mean, to say that about that, you couldn't really say that about the country today. You couldn't say the British citizens are intelligent, industrious, strong, persevere in inventiveness and resource, because we're multicultural and they all have these different traits, rather than all working together and all knowing what their strengths are and what their weaknesses are. We don't have that anymore. We just have mediocrity. We don't have any great geniuses. Well, continuing. Now, I assert that if the labour of the British people were properly organised and wisely applied, this country would, in return for very little toil, yield abundance for all. I assert that the labour of the British people is not properly organised, nor wisely applied, and I undertake to show how it might and should be organised and applied, and what would be the results if it were organised and applied in accordance with my suggestions. The ideal of British society today is the ideal of individual effort or competition. That is to say, every man for himself. Each citizen is to try as hard as he can to get for himself as much money as he can, and to use it for his own pleasure and leave it for his own children. That is the present personal ideal. The present national ideal is to become the workshop of the world. That is to say, the British people are to manufacture goods for sale to foreign countries, and in return for those goods are to get more money than they could obtain by developing the resources of their own country for their own use. And I'll stop there. And it's got even worse now. We're not the workshop of the world. We're not manufacturing goods for sale to foreign countries. We just sell financial instruments, and it's all about the City of London. And what he's basically saying here is that everything is about individualism. This idea of it's the individual's right to make as much profit as he can from the people around him. And that's a multicultural way of looking at things, because you're not looking at everybody around you as a member of your family. You want the family to succeed. You're just looking, I want to succeed, and I'm going to take whatever I can from these people that are around me. And it goes all right against nature, because everything that we have comes from the people that came before us. No man is an island. The smallest unit of the nation is the family, not the individual. So what we can see here is that this was just really starting to take off, this idea of individualism. And he's looking at it and saying, well, no, this is wrong. We're going about this the wrong way. I do believe you do have to have a certain amount of competition, but we should be competing as a nation with other nations, rather than having this internationalism. And we should also be trying to raise up those among us who are the best at doing things, rather than taking from those that are the best at doing things and diverting all the attention on those that are the worst at doing things, that are never going to be able to be as good as the others. So we do have to have a certain amount of help for individuals and a certain amount of competition, but it needs to be done in such a way that it advances the cause of the nation rather than the cause of the individual. I feel. What are your thoughts on what he has to say here, Max?
Well, I agree with the last statement that you just made, that we do need to provide a means by which the individual can achieve their life's fulfillment and can and can achieve their potential in terms of developing themselves and developing and in terms of improving their life and the life of their family. But that should always be second to the efforts that groups of individuals make in advancing the nation and making the nation strong and providing for the welfare of the nation. The nation must always come first, but we must also respect the desire of individuals to achieve their full potential as well. But it's got to be that way round. If it's not that way round, then what you have is individuals competing against each other. And as you say, you have a situation where there are where the people around you are no longer regarded as members of your family, but are regarded as punters that are there for you to exploit, as a resource for you to exploit, rather than as a community for you to nurture and protect and to develop and to uplift. And that's really what we've got to struggle to get over to the majority of people today, because you know the trends that Robert Blatchford argued against in the early 1900s are the same trends that still exist in Britain today, and it is the weakness of our country. You know, the desire to become the workshop of the world has meant that we have thrown over our economy to the mass production of finished goods and machinery and machine tools, etc., that in far greater quantities than we actually need, which has then meant that large areas of green land have been built over and concreted over in order to create these workshops. And of course, when you have an international economy where you're trying to be the workshop of the world, what happens is that there is a race to the bottom in terms of wages, where the country that has got the lowest wages is the country that's got the lowest production costs, and the country that is able to steal the technology of more inventive peoples is the country that has the lowest production costs, whereas the country that wants to look after the welfare of its people will have higher production costs. And the country where the people devote a lot of their energy to invention also will have the highest production costs. And so therefore, in a world economy where we try to be the workshop of the world, we are doomed effectively, because we will never be the cheapest people, or we shouldn't want to be the people work for the lowest wages. And so it requires a complete volt face as far as our industry in recent decades is concerned. And I mentioned last week about the way in which lots of third world countries are deterred from growing the food that their people need to eat, and instead are encouraged to grow tobacco crops and to grow palm oil crops and things of this sort, stuff that their people can't live on. And then what it means is that those third world countries are then vulnerable to changes in economic circumstances, where the prices of commodities change. And as the prices of commodities such as palm oil and tobacco change, then it can mean that their country experiences great hardship. And in that it experiences great hardship, if there's a drop in the price of tobacco, for example, that the people of that country can't eat tobacco leaves. And what they've got is a crop that they're then struggling to sell, and that they're then having to sell for a lower price, which means they've got less money to buy the food that they then need to feed themselves. So this isn't just a problem for Britain. This is a problem for all of the nations of the world, that the international commercial idea, the globalist commercial idea, has a massive flaw in it, and that flaw is that it encourages nations to organize themselves in such a way that they become overly dependent upon one industry, and often overly dependent upon an industry, the product of which is something that can't provide for their long-term security and can't provide for their nourishment during the bad years that come between the good years, effectively.
We've also got built-in obsolescence into the products that we do make, so that they break down and you have to purchase a new one, whereas before you used to be able to repair things and things were created with the idea that they would last forever and you would just repair them. And now also the workshop of the world is no longer Britain, it's China. I was quite surprised to see that the whole idea at the time was to say that Britain was going to be the workshop of the world, because I thought I thought they had them producing stuff out there in India, and this was the idea of the British Empire. But no, it was Britain that was doing all the work. It was Britain that was the workshop. And we're told, we have this white privilege. It was all just suddenly given to us. No, it wasn't. Our ancestors worked to the bone to provide what we have for us today. So it's interesting to see here the way that this all came about. Quoting again here. My ideal is that each individual should seek his advantage in cooperation with his fellows, and that the people should make the best of their own country before attempting to trade with other peoples. I propose, Mr. Smith, and I submit the proposal to you, who are a sensible and practical man, as a sensible and practical proposal, that we should first of all ascertain what things are desirable for our health and happiness of body and mind, and that we should then organize our people with the object of producing those things in the best and the easiest way. So what do you think he's really talking about here then, for the happiness of body and mind and desirable for our health? I guess for the health, he's talking about agriculture. Well, what about the happiness of body and mind? What sort of things is he talking about there that he wants us to be producing, Max, do you think?
Well, he's prioritising the uplifting of the amenity in which we live, making our housing better, making the environment better, making our population stronger and healthier and more vigorous than it otherwise would be, and placing those things above the drive for profit. Money has to change hands in a society in order to facilitate the purchase of things and the sale of things, and that's obvious. But the accumulation of ever increasingly large amounts of money serves no purpose other than to flatter the ego of the person who owns the means of production. And what we've got to try and do is to make people who are blessed with ownership of the means of production to see that their task, first and foremost, shouldn't be just to line their own pockets at the expense of the rest of the nation in order to by treating both the British people and foreigners alike as punters, that they want to sell their goods that are produced as cheaply as possible for the highest possible price, but that they should want the assets that they hold and the assets of our society as a whole to be used for the betterment of our people. And it's people that do that who really deserve to have their lives memorialized in statues and other monuments around the country. So it was in times gone by that people who created great wealth and who donated their great wealth to charitable causes, that they were celebrated and their lives were memorialized and monuments were built to them. And it's just a shame now that the work that they have done in the past is now being denigrated, and that the statues and the monuments are being despoiled.
I think what's at the root of this problem really is usury, because money should really just be a measure of value to facilitate exchange, the exchange of goods. And once you start adding interest to it, then money becomes a cause of its own, and people want to have as much money as they can, because then they can make as much money as they can out of it with usury, instead of it just being used as a measure of value. so that you can exchange one lot of goods for another.
But also in our society now, somebody who accumulates a massive fortune during their life is regarded as being a great and wonderful person because they've got all that money, irrespective of how they've actually accumulated that money. And what ought to be the measure of somebody is that, yes, if they can accumulate great wealth, then that's great. But what do they spend their great wealth on? And have they accumulated their great wealth simply by cheating other people? Because there is, you know, within economics, there is the drive for companies to find ever cheaper and cheaper and cheaper ways of producing whatever it is they sell. And of them then using advertising in order to be able to command the highest possible price for what they're selling. And I think it was Gerald Ratner who some decades ago fell from grace when he made a public admission when he was giving an after dinner speech that the object of his company was to, I think it was, I'm paraphrasing what he said, but it was to produce crap and to sell it at the highest possible price. And he said that as a perhaps a semi-serious joke at some after dinner speech, but it actually was the undoing of his company, and he lost a tremendous amount of tremendous amount of credit for doing that. But the point is, you know, in some respects, it was an admission of what lots of people in commerce have been doing over recent decades.
Yeah, and an admission of truth. And I mean, what happened to these great philanthropists? I mean, we've talked about some of them, you know, Edward Colston, Cecil Rhodes. I mean, these people that made lots of wealth in the past, they used that wealth to set up endowments, to set up hospitals, to set up schools, to provide ways for their people to better themselves, and that's why we have statues of them. And now they're saying, well, we must pull them down because they had something to do with the British Empire. And if it wasn't for the British Empire, half the people that are now telling us the British Empire is wrong would not have even been educated in the first place. They wouldn't have been given a scholarship. They wouldn't have been taught. They wouldn't have been educated. And it's scandalous. But yeah, to get back to the quotes here, now to our problem. How are we to make the best of our country and of our lives? What things do we need in order to secure a happy, healthy, and worthy human life? A life which consists of nothing but eating and drinking and sleeping and working is not a human life. It is the life of a beast. Such a life is not worth living. If we are to spend all our days and nights in a kind of penal servitude, continually toiling and suffering in order to live, we had better break at once the chains of our bitter slavery and die. And I think this is interesting, where he said where the things that people need as a human being, we need to be happy, we need to be healthy, and we need to have led a worthy human life. I mean, how many people today would count living a worthy human life as being of the utmost importance in how people are supposed to live? This gives us an idea of how moral the people were back then. It was considered important that what they did was actually worthy, not just all about hedonism, not just all about accumulating whatever you can for yourself, but did you do things for others during your life? Were you a worthy human being? I mean, that's what really strikes me about this quote here, Max.
Yeah, absolutely right. And again, it sort of comes back to how you measure the worth of somebody's life. Do you measure it by the size of their bank balance, irrespective of how that enormous bank balance may have been accumulated, or do you measure it by the amount of good that person's done in helping other people to be better than they otherwise might have been?
You know, I consider what we do here at Radio Albion to be very worthy. You know, we work here to try and provide content for our people, and we all see it as a duty that we do this. If we can do it, then we should. I'm proud of Radio Albion. I think it is a worthy enterprise. Getting back to these quotes here. To ensure good health, we must lead a natural life. The further we get from nature, the more artificial our lives become. The worse is our health. The chief ends to health are pure air, pure water, pure and sufficient food, cleanliness, exercise, rest, warmth, and ease of mind. The chief obstacles to health are impure air, impure water, bad or insufficient food, gluttony, drunkenness, vice, dirt, heavy labour, want of rest, exposure, and anxiety of mind. And once again, we see that the moral side here, the obstacles to health are gluttony, drunkenness, vice. And today, I mean, you've got pornography everywhere. You've got women selling themselves as pop stars and selling their bodies on the television, or showing off their bodies in order to make money. And that is not seen as an obstacle to health. We're being told that fat is beautiful. We're being told that we shouldn't even say the word fat. I forget what the word is now. Body something or other for overweight people. Never mind the fact
body positivity.
That's it. No, never mind the fact that obesity leads to, it leads to all sorts of diseases. Drunkenness. Think of the amount of drunkenness that we see on the streets, particularly with women now, over the weekends. And then also here, where he says, the further we get from nature, the more artificial our lives become. And again, as nationalists, we're all about adhering to natural law, and we lead synthetic lives now where we are completely separated from nature. And the air back then, I guess one good thing is that the air back now is much better than it was back then, when you think about the pea soup fogs that they had back then. Anything you want to add to that?
Also, one of the things that's quite interesting in that last statement that you read was the fact that back in the early part of the last century, Robert Blatchford had focused on anxiety of mind as being a key thing in producing ill health in the population. And it's only now, only in recent years, that the epidemic of mental illness has come to the fore, and that people have started to focus on the fact that there is so much mental illness. And the fact of the matter is that mental illness is exacerbated by the stresses that are created by living in multicultural societies, and societies where success is valued solely on how you look and how much money you have, and all the trappings of wealth. And yet Robert Blatchford, a national socialist, was already 100 years ago on the right track as far as that sort of thing is concerned, and several decades full of Labour and Conservative politicians have overlooked something he brought to the public for over 100 years ago.
I think also where he's talking here about the how we don't have the pure air, I think that was personal for him as well, because he had two children that died, didn't he, when they died young.
That's right.
I think it was to do with something to do with the lungs, I seem to remember. Well, continuing, the sure marks of good health are physical strength and beauty. Look at the statue of an ancient Greek athlete, and then at the form of a modern sweater's slave, and you will see how true this is. Now, this I think is very important, because we look at these Greek statues and we think they are the epitome of manhood, and obviously they look like they're working out in the gymnasium and they're incredibly fit. Well, no, that's what people used to look like. We've lost 20% of our testosterone in the last 20 years since they have been measuring it. It's dropped on average. Back then we had much more testosterone. We had people that were ill when they were young, they would die off. They wouldn't get to an adult age, and they wouldn't breed. And everybody was extremely fit and healthy. And if you're fit and healthy of body, you're going to be fit and healthy of mind. I mean, Dr. Edward Dutton has done loads of research into this, and the fact that there are more and more mutant genes which cause people to have uneven faces, unsymmetrical faces, ugly faces. And that is basically showing on the outside what is there on the inside. And that's why they have these maladaptive ideas. That's why we have these leftist ideas. That's why we have these suicidal ideas like multiculturalism and promotion of homosexualism. It's because they have these mutant genes. And the mutant genes show on the face where they're asymmetrical. And they also show on the inside on the brain. And he's pointing this out there in the language of the day, saying, look at the statue of an ancient Greek athlete. That is what you should look like. That is the example of physical strength, beauty, and health. And also that would have been a sign of mental strength. If you look at our politicians today, they're all so ugly. And I can't for the life of me think that our leaders looked anything like that in the past. I think they would have been the absolute epitome of beauty and health. They would have been high IQ, and they would have been absolutely beautiful looking, noble looking as well. Nothing like the ugliness that we see today in our politicians. They have ugly minds and ugly bodies. There is a link between the two. You know, to a certain extent, you can tell what somebody is like from looking at their facial features. There used to be an entire science in this, but now it's been made politically incorrect. But again, I think he's really sort of presaging things that we're finding out scientifically today. Back then, by pointing out these links between health, physical strength, beauty, and look at the Greek athlete, particularly to do with these hormone imbalances that we have today. I don't know if you want to add to that, Max.
I'm just trying to think whether it was Plato or Socrates that said monstrum in front, monstrum in animo, which basically meant that if you were a monster in appearance, you'll be a monster in spirit.
Yeah, well, just look at Gordon Brown. You know, I mean, even Boris Johnson, look at his hair. I mean, it's a right state. I guess Boris Johnson's probably better than most, but you compare that to Gordon Brown, it's just awful. He says, now I shall show you later that hardly any of our people lead natural and healthy lives. I shall show you that the average Briton might be very much healthier, handsomer, and stronger than he is. And I shall show you that the average duration of life might easily be doubled. I shall show you later that our people are badly clothed and badly fed and badly housed, that some have more, but most have less than is good for them, and that with a quarter of the labour now expended in getting improper sustenance, we might produce proper sustenance and plenty of it for all. And again, this is interesting because we know now that people back then, they didn't actually live to the fullness of their phenotype because of the bad diets that they actually had. And this is why when you look at in the past, some of the older houses have got lower doors and they've got lower ceilings. And it's because the people back then didn't have good enough food to eat. So they didn't actually reach the fullness of their phenotype. And we also know that people used to live a lot longer years ago. People used to live a lot longer because they had a much healthier diet. So he's also putting this link there between the diet that we have and the actual length of life that people have. He's saying that it could easily be doubled. I mean, that's quite incredible, that.
Well, I think it has almost, we're well on the way to doubling it, in fact, in view of the fact that I think the average life expectancy at birth for a man in 1900 was 52, whereas it's now something like 82. And so we've added 30 years onto that. But the point is that because of the fact that the rise in education, the rise in medical treatment, etc., that has caused the average life expectancy to increase in this country over the course of the last 100 years, because that rise has started to slow down and to stall, we're now seeing a situation where average life expectancy is starting to go down again, and that is as a result of the sort of modern trends in society. And so we do need to reverse the things that are making our country sick, and the primary thing that's making our country sick is the dispossession of our people and the mass immigration to this country, which is the source of so much of the hardship and so much of the problems that beset us in our society today.
The unnatural surroundings that we live in. I mean, living amongst people that aren't of your own kind, your body doesn't even produce the right hormones that it should be producing. Oxytocin is the hormone that we should be producing when we're around our own kind. It's the same hormone that is produced between a mother and the baby when the baby is suckling, to produce a sense of bonding between the two and a sense of happiness. And we produce this hormone when we're around our own people, and it's conducive to being social. And when we're around other races, we don't produce this hormone. We don't produce it, so we don't. Our bodies are not saying we should be sociable, we should be nice to these people. Our bodies are saying the opposite of that. So we're constantly on edge just because of the people we are around. And I also think an old saying used to be, "You are what you eat." So this is linked into it as well, not just the surroundings and the people that we are around, but also the food that we eat is so important. And he was realizing all of this and tying it into the nationalist ideology and the socialist ideology. Okay, and this week we're looking at quotes from Merry England, which was written by Robert Blatchford, who we've been talking about, the patriotic socialist with the glorious moustache. And this book he wrote in the early 20th century, and it's basically outlining how he sees socialism at the time. And it's based on looking after the people, making sure that they're well fed. And we went into some of the things that he was talking about last week, agriculture, and the fact that Britain was the workshop of the world. It was being seen as the workshop of the world, and that was to the detriment of farming, basically. And it meant that we were relying on other people all the time for everything. Much worse it's much worse today than we were back then. I mean, today we're relying on financial instruments all the time. But back then, they were relying on things that they could create. And of course, that's done by China now. And also, when he does this, he's talking to somebody else. He's trying to basically convince this chap called John Smith, who is the everyman, the British everyman, basically. So continuing with these quotes here from Merry England. "In the average lot of the average British workman, how much is there of knowledge and culture and science and art and music and the drama and literature and poetry and field sports and exercise and travel and change of scene? You know very well that our working people get little of these things, and you know that such as they do get are of inferior quality. Now I say to you that the people do not get enough of the things needful for body and mind, that they do not get them of the best, and that they do not get them because they have neither the money to pay for them nor the leisure to enjoy them. I say further that they ought to have, and might have, abundance of these things, and I undertake to show you how they can obtain them." And this is really good, because it's saying it's not just about food for the body, it's also food for the mind that we have. And yes. Learning about culture and music and science, and you have to have the time to be able to do these things. You have to have time off. And I would suggest also you need to have a garden, you need to have time off so that you can work in the garden and grow your own food. I don't know if he was an advocate of that as well, but that was an important thing that they actually did in National Socialist Germany with all the new houses, was make sure that they had enough space in the garden there. But also this introducing people to culture. I know that in National Socialist Germany, they would take the workers and they would take them to operas and they would take them to concerts, and they would try to introduce them to the glorious history of Germany in its culture. And the same thing should be done in Britain. We should be introducing people to the history of the theatre, say, in London and things like that. So he was all about expanding the world, the internal world that you have, and trying to better yourself as well, and trying to improve yourself, I think. What are your thoughts on this here, Max?
Yes, I agree 100% with what you've been saying, and I think one of the key things that we've learned from previous weeks with regard to Robert Blatchford is that his socialism was born out of his nationalism, and that the two really are indistinguishable. And so, he certainly would have been revolted by the silly song that we've just been talking about, and you know, he'd got as you say, a keen sense of what was required in order to create a strong and happy and healthy nation, and you're quite right in what you said, that the conditions that existed during the late 1800s and the early 1900s, where people worked very long hours for very low pay in factories that were often very dirty, and where they went back to crowded tenement style accommodation in the city centres, and where perhaps the most they could hope for would be a two up and two down terraced house or something of that sort, with perhaps a shared earth closet for the houses that were nearby, and these sort of conditions are not conducive to enabling the nation to thrive. And the nation is more than just the elite. The nation also consists of the workers of the nation, whether they're they contribute to the life of the nation, and that their needs have to be put in place. It is possible for there to be a ladder to success. So many politicians nowadays talk about helping people to progress in society. Well, you can't if there is a distinct two layers to society with a gulf in between, then it makes it very difficult for anybody who is of high ability, who is born into the masses of the population, for them to work their way up into the elite of the nation, if there is this vast gulf, and that vast gulf is exists in virtually every facet of life, from culture, from dance, from music, to all forms of the arts, etc., and as well as education. In order for people to be able to feel engaged in the mission that the nation has of making the nation stronger and more successful, and making the people that compose the nation happier and healthier and better provided for, mentally sounder, there needs to be a pathway to success that the ordinary person can follow.
I think the elites need to learn how to get their hands dirty, and the working classes need to be introduced to high culture so that you can take pride in your history. And of course, multiculturalism, how can they take pride in culture that's gone on for hundreds of years if they've only just arrived here and it wasn't their ancestors? Whereas, of course, back then, at this time that Blatchford is talking about, you could encourage people to learn about culture, and people are going to really take pride in that and say, well, yes, that was my ancestors that did this and came up with this idea and invented this. And it spurs people on to do the same. If you tell people that their ancestors were terrible people, they're just going to think that they themselves are terrible people. If you tell them that their ancestors did these wonderful, great, amazing things, and you are exactly the same as them, then that is encouraging people to better themselves and to improve themselves. And introducing people to culture and art and science, that's one of these ways of doing it. Continuing here, the Manchester School is the commercial school. The supporters of that school will tell you that you cannot prosper, that is to say, you cannot get a living, without the capitalist, without open competition, and without a great foreign trade. They will tell you that you would be very foolish to raise your own foodstuffs here in England, so long as you can buy them more cheaply from foreign nations. They will tell you that this country is incapable of producing enough food for her present population, and that therefore your very existence depends upon keeping the foreign trade in your hands. We hear a great deal about the value and extent of our foreign trade, and are always being reminded how much we owe to our factory system and how proud of it we ought to be. I despise the factory system and denounce it as a hideous, futile and false thing. Now, I would really question that, because from what I understand of it, the factory system is basically the line system where you have people working on a line, and they're all doing the same thing on the line, and whatever the product is, it passes from that line onto another line where everybody else is all doing the same thing, and you get good at doing it, you get very good at doing it. And I would suggest that so long as it was only for about 8 hours a day, and you weren't expected to be there all the time, and you had time off in which to experience culture and in which to work in your garden and spend your leisure time, and so long as you were paid well, I don't see really what's that wrong with the factory system. Perhaps it was a lot worse back then. Max, what do you think of what he's saying here about the factory system?
Well, I think in one respect, the factory system was where lots of people were crammed into very small workspaces very often, and were working in very dirty conditions that weren't conducive to health. And I think that's one of the reasons why he was opposed to the factory system. The other aspect of the factory system, though, is that if your job is to screw on the third nut from the left, and all you do is you sit there all day long as each motor vehicle, for example, comes past, or each washing machine comes past, and all you do is you screw on the third nut from the left, and the person sitting to your left had screwed on the second nut from the left, and the person next on had screwed on the first nut, and the person to your right screws on the fourth nut to the from the left, then at the end of the day, if you go home and you have a washing machine produced by your factory in your house, and that washing machine breaks down, your wife is going to perhaps turn around to you and say to you, or your husband, if it was a woman that was working in the factory, and say, "You make these washing machines, don't you? Can't you fix it?" And of course, the person who's just been screwing on the third nut from the left doesn't know how to fix a washing machine. They don't know how a washing machine works. They've got the faintest idea what components, what other components are bolted onto the frame of that washing machine, because all they do is they screw the third nut to the left. And so it's reducing the appreciation of the work that they do for the person. It's denying them the pleasure of pride in their work, because any idiot can screw the third nut on from the left if they've been given a screwdriver and know which way is clockwise. But it takes somebody with some accomplishment to know how to build a washing machine. And if you're going to appeal to a mass market, and what you want to do is you want to produce, let's say, washing machines more cheaply than they're produced anywhere else in the world, so that you can become the workshop of the world, then what you're going to do is you're going to want people who just sit there all day screwing the third nut from the left. But the point is, if what you want is a happy and a knowledgeable population, and a population that gets a real sense of satisfaction from the work that they do, then what you really ought to have is people working in perhaps groups. And you could have, say, a group of four people who start off with the chassis, the frame of the washing machine, and who then build the washing machine from scratch. They bolt all the parts on in all the right places, test it, and then put their washing machine on a production line, that then on a conveyor belt that then takes it out of the factory, where it's then all wrapped up in whatever protective material, and shipped off to the shops. That way, the people that are making the washing machine from scratch will know how to build a washing machine, and when they go home and the washing machine breaks down in their home, they'll know which part is broken, which part needs to be replaced. They can fix their own washing machine, and they are elevated because they've got a skill and they've got knowledge that they wouldn't have had otherwise. They're just treated as a flesh part of the machine if all they're doing is screwing the third nut from the left. Whereas if they actually build, even though it may be with a group of other people, if they build a washing machine from scratch, then they're washing machine builders.
So what you're talking about there is turning the means into an end in itself, rather than the end justifies the means. You're turning the means into an end in itself, and you're combining artisanship with the factory system, and looking at it, well, how can we actually benefit the people while they're doing this at the same time? And that's the nationalist way of looking at it. I think that was very well explained, Max. Well, continuing, the Manchester School will tell you that the destiny of this country is to become the workshop of the world. I say that is not true, and that it would be a thing to deplore if it were true. The idea that this country is to be the workshop of the world is a wilder dream than any that the wildest socialist ever cherished. But if this country did become the workshop of the world, it would at the same time become the most horrible and the most miserable country the world has ever known. Let us be practical and look at the facts. First, as to the question of beauty and pleasantness. You know the factory districts of Lancashire. I ask you, is it not true that they are ugly and dirty and smoky and disagreeable? Compare the busy towns of Lancashire, of Staffordshire, of Durham and of South Wales with the country towns of Surrey, Suffolk and Hants. In the latter countries you will get pure air, bright skies, clear rivers, clean streets and beautiful fields, woods and gardens. You will get cattle and streams and birds and flowers. And you know that all these things are well worth having and that none of them can exist side by side with the factory system. So I guess what he's saying here is, I mean, I think we have seen some of this, you know, actually being changed, haven't we? The way that factories are built now, they build trees and shrubbery around it. They try to build parks. They try to make life a little bit easier for the workers. And this also reminds me of when he suggested earlier that a good book to read was George Stephenson, because he set up the railway system, and he set that up in Swindon, didn't he? And apparently he also set up hospitals for the workers. So he was thinking, how can we make it so that people are living here and they're working in a factory style, and make it so that it's pleasant for them at the same time, and they have a sense of community. And I've worked in factories where they've had clubs, they've had bars, they've really looked after the people there. And I've worked in other factories where they really haven't looked after the people, and it's been, you know, the same thing as you were describing earlier, Max, about, you know, just doing the one nut on the right. So there are two different ways that this can be done. What do you think of what he's saying here?
Oh, well, I entirely agree with him. You know, and he's pointing out the difference between Lancashire, Staffordshire, Durham and South Wales with the more pleasant counties of England. I mean, there are pleasant places. Let's not say they're not. There are pleasant places in Lancashire and Staffordshire, but there are, if you go to the, if you look where the work is done in those counties, there is far more industrialization, and and there are factories to a far greater extent in Lancashire and Staffordshire and Durham, etc., than there are in Surrey, Suffolk and Hampshire, where there are farms, generally speaking, and where, as Blatchford says, that there are clear streams and blue skies and green hedgerows, etc. And it's much better for people to live in an environment that is conducive to their health than it is for them to work in a grimy environment which has the opposite effect. I think that, you know, from the previous conversation we've had, you can see that if you have, I mean, even where you have factories, and because I wouldn't say you shouldn't have factories in the more rural towns either, you know, if you have a factory where people are effectively craftsmen, where they're making the vehicle or they're making the machine, and they're doing it from scratch so that they've got pride in their work, then that is a far more wholesome system, and it's one that where the deleterious effects of industrialization will be minimal compared with the way that they become dominant in a heavily industrialized context. You know, I can remember working in a factory many, many years ago. I worked in a place that's now been demolished. It was called the press shop in Luton, in the Vauxhall factory that was there. As I say, it's now been pulled down, so it's no longer there. But that press shop was the most disgustingly dirty place I have ever been in my life. You know, if you cut your hand on anything, if you pricked your finger on anything, you could get virtually guarantee that you would end up with an abscess starting to form where you had the cut. Such would be the infectious nature of the internal surface of that building. And it was like every internal surface of the building was covered with grime and sludge. And it was a very, very dirty place. And yet, if you go into other places, if you were to visit, for example, the Aston Martin workshops that exist in just outside Milton Keynes, Newport Pagnell, Then what you'd see there is beautifully clean workshops where people work with gloves on, and where the floors are clean and the surfaces are clean. And so it's just there are two different ways of doing it, and I firmly believe that the second of those two ways is the way that we should follow.
I think Cadbury's were known for looking after their people, and you know, I think as far as factories in rural areas go, so long as they're not polluting the environment, then, you know, I think it's quite a good idea. And you, because it provides work for the people in that rural environment, and you have a sense of community because they're all working at the factory, and it means that they can stay in that rural environment. But it has to be very environmentally friendly, because as you pointed out there, Max, you know, there's a lot of pollution and dirt and sludge which is associated with these factories. Again, it's taking notice of the land itself as well as the people, and trying to make everything that we do conducive to the land and also to the people. Continuing here, do you find the champions of the factory system despising nature and beauty and art and health, except in their speeches and lectures to you? No, you will find these people living as far from the factories as they can get, and you will find them spending their long holidays in the most beautiful parts of England, Scotland, Ireland, or the continent. The pleasures that they enjoy are denied to you. They preach the advantages of the factory system because they reap the benefits, whilst you bear the evils. To make wealth for themselves, they destroy the beauty and the health of your dwelling places, and then they sit in their suburban villas or on the hills and terraces of the lovely southern counties and sneer at the sentimentality of the men who ask you to cherish beauty and to prize health. As a practical man, would you of your own choice convert a healthy and beautiful county like Surrey into an unhealthy and hideous county like Wigan or Cradley, just for the sake of being able once a year to go to Blackpool and once a night to listen to a cracked piano? I find this interesting as well, because it's sort of telling us what the country used to be like. There used to be these areas that were really built up with factories and really dirty and horrible, grotty places to be. And then there were other parts of the country which were much more pleasant. And I think we can see here maybe an early division between the south and the north, with all the factories up north and all the pleasant parts of the country in the home counties. Would I be right in thinking that, Max?
There was that tendency. That's right. Yes, that kind of a divide did start to develop. The division between the north and the south has also developed as a result of it being cheaper to export goods from the south of Britain to the continent, for example, cheaper than it would be to export goods from the north of Britain to the continent, just by virtue of the geography. So, you know, there is a certain amount of geography involved, but then there is the coincidence that the Industrial Revolution started in the north of England, and so that's where a lot of industry became sited initially, and the south and the east of Britain, to a great extent, was regarded as being the breadbasket of the nation, as opposed to being the industrial heartland.
So that was a bit where all the rich people lived, and then you had all the poor people working their fingers to the bone in these factories in the north. Continuing, now I tell you, my practical friend, that you ought to have, and may have, good music, and good homes, and a fair and healthy country, and more of all the things that make life sweet, that you may have them at less cost of labour than you now pay for the privilege of existing in Oldham, and that you can never have them if England becomes the workshop of the world. But the relative beauty and pleasantness of the factory and country districts do not need demonstration. The ugliness of Widnes and Sheffield and the beauty of Dorking and Monsaldale are not matters of sentiment nor of argument. They are matters of fact. The value of beauty is not a matter of sentiment. It is a fact. You would rather see a squirrel than a sewer rat. You would rather bathe in the Avon than in the Irwell. You would prefer the fragrance of a rose garden to the stench of a sewage works. You would prefer Bolton Woods to Ancota slums. As for those who sneer at beauty as they spend fortunes on pictures, on architecture, and on foreign tours, they put themselves out of court. Sentiment or no sentiment, beauty is better than ugliness, and health is better than disease. Now, under the factory system, you must sacrifice both health and beauty. And I find it really interesting here that he's placing so much value on beauty, and he's saying it's objective, it's not subjective. Beauty is objective, and it's based on symmetry, it's based on nature, it's based on the golden mean. And we're being told today, oh, fat is beautiful. We have modern art, we're told beauty is completely subjective. It's not, it's natural, and we naturally yearn to see what is beautiful, and what is ugly is unhealthy, and what is beautiful is healthy. And it's a really good description of that here. And it's not politically correct to say these things anymore, you know, because beautifulness and ugliness is supposed to be equal today. And that's the way that I think we're going anyway. Max, what are your thoughts on his talk of beauty here?
Again, I agree. I think that there was a movement towards beautifying the country during the early part of the last century, and this was in, you've mentioned Cadbury's, and there were quite a number of Quaker industrialists who shared the views of Robert Blatchford, and as if you go to Bourneville, which is part of Birmingham now, I believe. Bourneville is what the Bourneville chocolate bar is named after, but Bourneville was an ideal village that was created by the Cadbury family to house the workers at their factory in Birmingham, and it's complete with ornamental gardens and open spaces, etc., that were designed to create a pleasant life for the people and a healthy life for the people that worked in the Cadbury factory. And Cadbury's weren't alone. There were a number of other Quaker families that did the same thing. I think if you go to Hemel Hempstead, you can still find the Ovaltine Farm, where the family who first started producing Ovaltine did so in a very kind of rural circumstances. And that still remains as a kind of a museum or as a relic to the work that family tried to implement many, many years ago. And then there were the garden cities that were created. The only one, the name of which that's immediately springs to mind is Letchworth, which is one that I'm quite familiar with. But if you go to Letchworth, then again, Letchworth town centre is set out very, very ornamentally. There are lots of open spaces. It was also a fact that initially it wasn't possible to have pubs in Letchworth. There was the family who, or certainly the organisation that was set up in order to create Letchworth, decided that temperance was one of the things that was needed in order to create a healthy workforce, and so they had a bylaw that it was illegal for anybody to open a public house within a certain area of Letchworth. And it was during my early years, so we're going back quite several decades here, that was changed, and Letchworth started to have public houses. But Letchworth is still a very pleasant place to go to, and it's interesting that just on the very edge of Letchworth there is one of the largest rose farms, for want of a better word, there, which is world famous, and where they produce roses that are rose plants that are then exported all over the world. And so, and you know, as I say, Letchworth is a very pleasant place. But it, as the 20th century progressed, the globalist viewpoint both infected the Labour Party and also infected the Conservative Party. This move towards beautifying the country and having these garden towns and garden cities started to fall away. And the lessons that were learned in the early part of the 20th century and the lessons that were learned as a result of the work done by Blatchford were have become forgotten and ignored. And so now we find ourselves in a situation where we have a national minimum wage that nobody can live on. You know, you can just about exist on the national minimum wage, but if you're a single, an individual person. But if you were, if you wanted to start a family and buy a house of your own and raise children, then you would not be able to do that on the national minimum wage. And so, you know, here we are in a situation where the national minimum wage has virtually become the standard wage that's paid to anybody who's working in an industrial or low-skilled commercial environment. And it's not a wage that enables people to live the kind of lives that people would want to. It's not the sort of wage that would enable people to appreciate culture and to participate in the cultural life of the nation, or that would enable them to take holidays regularly in the beautiful parts of the country, to enjoy the landscape and to enjoy the natural amenities that these British Isles have to offer. It's just sad, really, that sort of thing has been lost. But there is hope in the fact that British nationalists still cleave to the ideas of Robert Blatchford. And so there is still hope if people in sufficient numbers change their voting habits and people start to vote for organisations such as Patriotic Alternative, then there is still hope that the situation in this country can be turned around and we can become a green and pleasant land again.
And beauty and nature are conducive to good health, aren't they? There's nothing quite as beautiful as Britain in the summertime in the countryside. Getting back to Blatchford here, as to my second objection, the evil effect of the factory system on the public health. What are the chief means to health? Pure air, pure water, pure and sufficient food, cleanliness, exercise, rest, warmth, and ease of mind. What are the invariable accompaniments of the factory system? Foul air, foul water, adulterated foods, dirt, long hours of sedentary labour, and continual anxiety as to wages and employment in the present, added to a terrible uncertainty as to existence in the future. Look through any great industrial town in a colliery, the iron, the silk, the cotton, or the woolen industries, and you will find hard work, unhealthy work, vile air, overcrowding, disease, ugliness, drunkenness, and a high death rate. These are the facts. And I find it interesting, he brings up ease of mind there, which you mentioned last week, mental health, and he brings up here continual anxiety as to wages and employment, as you were just pointing out there, Max, to the minimum wage that we have now. And also now we have these zero-hour contracts. Instead of things getting better and there being more security, there is less security. There used to be more security, I think, in the 60s. I mean, when you were working in a factory, you were guaranteed a job for life, basically, and you would be looked after. But nowadays, when you go and work in a factory, it's all temping work. It's all 0 hours contracts. There's no guarantee of getting future work, and there is this anxiety of where you're going to be next year. You're not able to even work your way up in these factories anymore. So I think it did improve around about by the time of the 60s, but we've definitely gone downhill now in the factory system. What do you think of what he has to say here, Max?
Yeah, as I say, I'm thoroughly in agreement with just about everything that Robert Blatchford writes about. And what you've just sort of reiterated that I've just said about the national minimum wage and 0 hours contracts is again very true. And it's something that I can recall from my school days. I can recall teachers talking to the class about how when science advanced and automation came in, that we would all share in the greater wealth that these things would create, and that instead of people having to work for 50 hours a week or whatever it was in those days, we'd be able to work for less, for 40 hours a week, and then for less, for 30 hours a week, and that the benefits of having that mechanization would enable people to work for fewer hours, but because of the mechanization, for productivity to be maintained, and therefore for there to be the profits necessary in order for companies to continue to pay people for the work that they do and to pay them a living wage, a wage that they could actually live on and lead a life on. And lead a fulfilling life on, and that it was going to be the leisure industry that was going to be the great benefactor of all this additional free time that we would have, because we'd all have the same kind of spending money, but we'd be spending it on leisure pursuits instead of spending the money on providing for the bare necessities of life. But what's happened is that as mechanization and automation has been introduced, the factory system, as Blatchford calls it, which is basically monetarism and capitalism. And as Blatchford describes it, capitalism has come into the fore, where instead of the wealth created by automation and by transistorization and all these kind of things, instead of that wealth being dissipating down to the working people to create a happier, healthier, more leisure oriented, more arts oriented, more science oriented nation, we have that the money has just been hived off into the pockets of the global capitalists, and we find ourselves having to compete with other countries where the standard of living isn't as high as the standard of living is in our country, and where the only way we can compete with those nations on the basis of cheapness of product is by us accepting the lower and lower and lower standard of living that is on offer, until our standard of living will be no different from the standard of living in the poor countries that are competing against us.
They've forgotten that the economy is supposed to serve us. I mean, that mechanization that you're talking about, that would have worked, but if we hadn't have imported 10 times as many people into the country, and the mechanization would have meant less hours of work, more leisure time, and with the encouragement to improve yourself, you know, it could have meant that everybody did improve themselves, but we didn't, because the people that are running this system are just running it for their own benefit. They're not running it for the good of the nation. They have no interest in the nation. They don't want people to discover that they're actually members of a nation. They want to change the meaning of the word nation to mean just a piece of paper, just a club of values, rather than it being your extended family. Well, I think we should probably leave that there for this week, Max, and unless you've got anything else to say.
No, that's fine. I think it's a good point.
Thank you very much for listening. In the next episode of Greatest Britons, we will be continuing with the quotes from Robert Blatchford's book, Merry England, and we look forward to seeing you again at that time.